And now it's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Uncle Dennis here in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM and www.freakradio.org. Want to ask you to have a pencil and paper handy on this September 8th, 2016, so that you can take down notes about names, addresses, telephone numbers, web pages, any information you need to be able to take action. Let's start off with some announcements. Here in Santa Cruz, tomorrow evening, Friday, September 9th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Museum of Art and History, a program called The Water Remembers Us, the story of the Winnemem Wintu, the salmon, and how the water connects us. The Santa Cruz Indigenous Solidarity will be hosting Chief Kalik Sisk of the Winnemem Wintu tribe from the Mount Shasta area to speak about an upcoming prayer run for salmon, for the return of the salmon and the tribe's ongoing efforts to protect water and land. The evening will also include interactive activities, crafts, a short film, and closes with a community water ceremony. That is tomorrow evening, Friday, September 9th, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Museum of Art and History, 705 Front Street. There is a suggested donation at the door, so bring some money to help those folks out. And join us for a cleanup day on Alameda Creek on September 17th. Help the Alameda Creek Alliance clean trash and clear invasive plants along Alameda Creek in Niles, California, as part of the Creeks to Bay Coastal Cleanup Day on Saturday, September 17th from 10 a.m. to noon. In addition to trash, we'll work on removing some of the invasive plants that have recently been found out at our Niles Canyon Restoration site. Come enjoy the morning among friends and neighbors along a beautiful stretch of Alameda Creek. This continues past work by ACA volunteers, and your efforts will enhance habitat for fish and wildlife along Alameda Creek for years to come. Meet at 10 a.m. at the Niles Staging Area parking lot along Old Canyon Road near Canyon Oaks Court in Niles area of Fremont. The address is roughly 720 Old Canyon Road. They'll work till about noon. Please wear long pants and sturdy closed-toed shoes that can get dirty, no sandals or flip-flops. We provide gloves and tools. The work isn't on much of a slope, but the ground can be uneven. There is no poison oak in the immediate area where we'll be working. Do expect cool weather and morning dew when we start, but it might warm up later in the morning. All participants need to sign waiver forms, one from the Alameda Creek Alliance and one for Alameda County, and anyone under 18 needs to have a parental signature. Please visit the website alamedacreek.org for information on how to RSVP, and you'll find the required forms and more details at the site. Once again, that's Saturday, September 17th in the Niles Staging Parking Area for the Alameda Creek Alliance Creeks to Bay Coastal Cleanup Day. Anyway, alamedacreek.org for more information on that one. And here's some news from Oregon Wild. The Oregon we love today did not come easily. Preserving each and every one of Oregon's special places, from Three Sisters Wilderness to Steens Mountain, took the time, energy, and devotion of countless activists. The Tim Lillibo Wildlands Warrior Award was created as a way to honor the legacy of Tim Lillibo, a tireless and tenacious advocate for our wildlands, wildlife, and waters, and to recognize those who likewise have gone above and beyond in their efforts to protect Oregon's treasures. Over the past few years, extreme off-road vehicle users have carved illegal off-road trails through the botanically rich High Siskiyou Meadow. This unique wildflower habitat, known for pollinators and a spring important to hikers on the Pacific Crest Trail, is also a historic site. Several picnic tables and a rustic shelter were built by the Civilian Conservation Corps in 1936, and there is also a cabin built by the Soil Conservation Service in the 1930s. Thanks to the work of the Northwest Youth Camp, the National Forest Service, and Klamath Siskiyou Wild, this one-of-a-kind place is now protected with a rustic wooden fence to keep off-road vehicles out. We are excited to announce that Oregon Wild is accepting 2016 nominations for the Wildlands Warrior Award From forest activists to field biologists, environmental attorneys to elected officials, we welcome nominations from all across Oregon and from all walks of life. The winner will be announced at the Call of the Wild on October 14th. For more information and for your nomination, go to www.oregonwild.org. That's www.oregonwild.org. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. The Buffalo Field Campaign's 2016 West Coast Roadshow begins next week. On Monday, Mike Meese will be leaving Yellowstone and heading west for what promises to be the most inspiring roadshow and outreach tour yet. Joined by musician Mignon Gelly, we will be bringing the Buffalo story and Buffalo Field Campaigns. That's not what it says there. We will be brining. No, I think they're going to be bringing the Buffalo story and Buffalo Field Campaign activists to at least 18 venues in Washington, Oregon, and California between September 15th and October 9th. Mignon will be playing her beautiful and inspiring native flute music on the whole tour, and special musical guests will join along the way. If we are coming to your community, or if you have friends or family along the route, please help spread the word. You can print posters at the Buffalo Field Campaign website, invite your friends, and of course, don't forget to come yourself. For more information, the posters and the dates are at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. That's buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And arrest warrants have been issued for Green Party candidate Jill Stein for spray-painting a bulldozer at a No Dakota Access Pipeline protest. The story by Eliza Collins of USA Today is found on the Earth First Newswire. Here is the Earth First Update producer's note. Normally, the Earth First Update doesn't cover political campaigns, but when a candidate is involved in nonviolent civil disobedience, we had to present this news item. Here is the Earth First Newswire editor's note. We really hope Stein and Baraka will read a zine on security culture before their next action. Sure, this vandalism was likely just a photo op designed to get us eco-radicals to vote Green Party this election, much like when Stein was arrested at the tar sands blockade during her last run at the White House 4 years ago. But still, if you're going to do it right. Arrest warrants have been issued for Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein and her running mate Ajuma Baraka. The pair are facing misdemeanor charges of criminal trespass and criminal mischief after they spray-painted bulldozers during a protest on Tuesday, according to Morton County Sheriff's Department in North Dakota. Stein and Baraka were participating in a protest against the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota. The Stein campaign confirmed that the Green Party candidate did spray-paint "I approve this message" on a bulldozer. According to the sheriff's office, video also shows Baraka painting the word "decolonization" as part of the sentence, "We need decolonization." Stein is not apologizing, though. I hope North Dakota authorities press charges against the real vandalism taking place at Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The bulldozing of sacred burial sites and the unleashing of vicious attack dogs, she said in a statement. Our campaign supports the courageous indigenous leaders who are taking a stand to protect future generations from the deadly greed of the fossil fuel industry. And you can find that and other stories at earthfirstjournal.org/newswire. And the northern spotted owl has been listed by the Fish and Game Commission here in California in this story by Tom Wheeler of the Environmental Protection Information Center. By a unanimous vote, the California Fish and Game Commission has listed the northern spotted owl under the California Endangered Species Act. The commission's decision ended a four-year review process first initiated by the Environmental Protection Information Center's petition for listing in 2012. The northern spotted owl is under siege on many fronts. Northern spotted owls are threatened with extinction by past and ongoing habitat loss, primarily to timber harvests, which can exacerbate competition from aggressive and invasive barred owls. The increasingly rare and old-growth forest-adapted owls are now understood to be at risk from the use of rodenticides and other poisons used in large-scale trespass marijuana operations, and there is increasing concern about the impacts of climate change on forest ecosystems that the owls call home. The listing of the northern spotted owl is one small step towards recovery, said Tom Wheeler, program director at the Environmental Protection Information Center. The owl was here long before we were. It is our moral obligation to ensure that the owl will continue to roam our forests long after we are gone. Well, the northern spotted owl is found across the West Coast. California's population is the species' greatest stronghold. Protecting California's owls is key to protecting the species at large. The northern spotted owl has been listed as threatened under the Federal Endangered Species Act since 1990. The listing of the northern spotted owl has slowed the decline of the spotted owl but has not arrested it. Additional protections and conservation measures are necessary to stop the owl's decline and to put it on a track for recovery. As evidenced by the owl's decline, our current protections are not up to snuff, said Rob DePerna, forest and wildlife advocate for the Environmental Protection Information Center. I hope that all stakeholders can set aside differences and work together towards recovery. If you want more information, go to www.wildcalifornia.org. That's wildcalifornia, all one word, .org. And wolf advocates have rallied to move cows off of public land in this story by Don Jenkins of Capital Press, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Wolf advocates rallied recently outside the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, calling on the state to immediately stop shooting wolves and for livestock to be removed from public lands. Meanwhile, across the state, ranchers in northeastern Washington are trying to prevent depredations on cattle over a wide swath of the Colville National Forest. We do everything we can to protect the cattle. The only other thing we could do is to not turn them out, said Justin Hedrick, co-owner of the Diamond M Ranch, the most high-profile of cattle operations losing cattle to livestock in the forest this summer. I think he meant to say losing cattle to wolves in the forest this summer. We're not the only ones affected. We're the ones getting the media on it, he said. Nobody wants the attention, but we feel we have to put ourselves out there for there to be remedies. As of last week, the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife had reported shooting of 6 wolves in the Profanity Peak Pack. WDFW was due to break its week-long silence and issue an update in the afternoon on the hunt for the pack's remaining 5 wolves. Since WDFW's last update, emotions have risen. Hedrick said his family, which has grazed cattle in the Colville National Forest for 73 years, have been threatened. We're getting death threats every day, he said. It's very troubling. They call all day long, all night long. At the rally, Amarok Weiss of the Center for Biological Diversity told some 80 wolf advocates that nobody should be threatened. That has no place in this discussion at all, she said after the rally. Weiss said Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife's policy of not providing more frequent updates on its wolf hunt has created an information void. I think that's a flaw in their protocol, she said. The information void has been filled, though with questionable accuracy. Washington State University issued a statement Wednesday repudiating comments by Rob Wiglis, the director of the university's large carnivore conservation. Wiglis told the Seattle Times that the Diamond M Ranch released cows on top of a wolf's den. The university called the comments inaccurate and inappropriate and that cows were turned out more than 4 miles from the den. Hedrick said depredations were occurring over a large area and forcing cows from the high-elevation pastures they moved towards in the late summer. It's completely disrupting our entire program, he said. The wolves are in an area 30 miles wide and 30 to 40 miles long. Colville National Forest spokesman Franklin Pemberton said about 4,400 cow-calf pairs are grazing over 583,000 acres in the 1.1 million-acre forest. Depredations have occurred on 4 grazing allotments in 2 watersheds, he said. I think it's safe to say there aren't too many places in the national forest where there aren't wolves. Pemberton said the Forest Service went over grazing plans with the Diamond M Ranch owners, including Bill McGirvin, Hedrick's uncle. WDFW was also involved in pre-grazing discussions about how to avoid conflicts, he said. Mr. McGirvin is a permittee in good standing, Pemberton said. He's doing everything right in our view. He turned out when he was supposed to, where he was supposed to. With several troopers standing by, the wolf rally was spirited and peaceful. Wolf activist Brett Haverstick of Moscow, Idaho, led the protesters in a call-and-response chant, "Remove the cattle, save the wolves." Eliminating livestock on public lands was a major theme of the rally, along with sympathy for hunted wolves. "Let's not call this lethal control. Let us not call this lethal removal. They are both sanitized terms," Weiss said. "Livestock were characterized as interlopers. Wolves are native. Livestock are invasive," Haverstick added. Wolf advocates note that ranchers who enter into preventive agreements with WDFW and still lose livestock to wolves are eligible for compensation. And if you'd like more information, go to theearthfirstjournal.org newswire. And millions of bees are dead after South Carolina sprays for Zika mosquitoes in this story by Ben Guarino of the Washington Post, as found on the Earth First Newswire. Last week, South Carolina honeybees began to die in massive numbers. Death came suddenly to Dorchester County, South Carolina. Stressed insects tried to flee their nests only to surrender in little clumps at hive entrances. The dead worker bees littering the farm suggested that colony collapse disorder was not the culprit. In that odd phenomenon, workers' bees vanish as though raptured, leaving a living queen and young bees behind. Instead, the dead heaps signaled the killer was less mysterious but no less devastating. The pattern matched acute pesticide poisoning. By one estimate, at a single apiary, Flower Town Bee Farm and Supply in Somerville, 46 hives died on the spot, totaling 2.5 million bees. Walking through the farm, one Somerville woman wrote on Facebook, "It was like visiting a cemetery, pure sadness." A Clemson University scientist collected soil samples from Flower Town on Tuesday, according to WCBD-TV, to further investigate the cause of death. But to the bee farmers, the reason is already clear. Their bees had been poisoned by Dorchester's own insecticide efforts, casualties in the war on disease-carrying mosquitoes. On Sunday morning, parts of Dorchester County were sprayed with NALED, a common insecticide that kills mosquitoes on contact. The United States began using NALED in 1959, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, which notes that the chemical dissipates so quickly it is not a hazard to people. That said, human exposure to NALED during spraying should not occur. In parts of South Carolina, trucks hauling pesticide clouds are not an unusual sight, thanks to a mosquito control program that also includes destroying larvae. Given the current concerns of West Nile virus and Zika, there are several dozen cases of travel-related Zika in South Carolina, though the State Health Department reports no one has yet acquired the disease from a local mosquito bite. Dorchester decided to try something different on Sunday. It marked a departure from Dorchester County's usual ground-based efforts. For the first time, an airplane dispensed NALED in a fine mist, raining insect death from above between 6:30 and 8:30 a.m. Sunday. The county says it provided plenty of warning, spreading the word about the pesticide plane via a newspaper announcement on Friday and a Facebook post on Saturday. Local beekeepers felt differently. "Had I known, I would have been camping on the steps doing whatever I had to do, screaming, 'No, you can't do this,'" beekeeper Juanita Stanley said in an interview with Charleston WCSC-TV. Stanley told the Charleston Post and Courier that the bees are her income, but she was more devastated by the loss of the bees than her honey. The county acknowledged the bee deaths on Tuesday. Dorchester County is aware that some beekeepers in the area that was sprayed on Sunday lost their beehives, Jason Ward, county administrator, said in a news release. He added, "According to the Charleston Post and Courier, I am not pleased that so many bees were killed." Spraying the lead from the area is not unprecedented, particularly when covering areas that cannot be reached by truck. In a single year in Florida, more than 6 million acres were fumigated with the chemical, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The agency argued in January that the technique should be used to curb Zika in Puerto Rico, but the insect neurotoxin cannot discriminate between honeybees and blood-sucking mosquitoes. A profile of the chemical in Cornell University's pesticide database warned that the lead is highly toxic to bees. A Somerville resident stated that has started a change.org petition calling for Dorchester County to halt aerial lead spraying. It is unclear whether those who lost bees are pursuing other recourse. And once again, earthfirstjournal.newswire. And the pika is being threatened by a warming climate in this story by Nicholas Kuznets of Inside Climate News. Scientists have warned for years that a climate warming will threaten many of the world's species, but for one diminutive alpine creature, the threat has already arrived. The American pika is disappearing from much of its mountain habitat across the western United States, with rising temperatures a driving factor, a new study says. The findings, said lead author Eric A. Beaver, a research ecologist with the United States Geological Survey, also point to a much larger problem. This is kind of an indication of what's happening in our mountain ecosystems, Beaver said, pointing out that the rivers that feed the West cities have their origin in pika habitat. The findings, published last week in the Journal of Mammalogy, paint a troubling picture. Beaver and 14 colleagues surveyed more than 900 locations across three western regions. In there, in Northern California, the Great Basin, and Southern Utah, where pikas are known to live, their searches carried out throughout 2014 and 15 found that the creature had vanished from locations across each region. In California, pikas had disappeared from 38% of the sites in the Great Basin, which lies between the Rockies and the Sierra Nevada Mountains. 44% of the locations are now pika-free. They were unable to find a single pika in Zion National Park in southern Utah, where the animals had been recorded as recently as 2011. Beaver and other researchers have been warning about and chronicling the pika's decline for more than a decade, but the new work broadened the research across a greater extent of the animal's range, which stretches from New Mexico to southern Canada and is limited almost exclusively to rocky outcrops high in the mountains. The hamster-like creatures, which are a distant relative of the rabbit, weigh less than 8 ounces, but they're talkative and easy to spot, making them prime subjects for study. The remote habitat is also relatively undisturbed by human development. The pika has been labeled one of the cutest creatures alive. It rubs its cheeks on rocks to mark its territory. It is not, however, well-suited for a warming world. It has this characteristic of essentially being a big fur ball, which is really a great strategy if you live on top of a snowy, cold mountain and want to stay alive in those temperatures, said Mark C. Urban, who studies the effects of climate change on animals at the University of Connecticut. Urban, who was not involved in the pika research report, compared its condition to wearing a fur coat on a hot summer day. Humans could take off that fur coat, but the American pika can't. Their mountain habitats are like islands in the sky surrounded by warm, often uncrossable valleys, so they have trouble shifting to new territory. And as climate changes push warmer temperatures further up mountain slopes, these sky islands are becoming smaller and scarcer. Scientists had long theorized that creatures in isolated ecosystems would be among the most vulnerable to climate change, Urban said, and that they'd decline at a faster rate than other species. The new study solidifies the theory, he said. The pika serves as an early warning for other species, he added. Despite these threats, the Obama administration in 2010 rejected a bid to add the American pika to the endangered species list, although the animal is up for consideration again. And it's not all bad news for the pika. Beaver and colleagues have found out that they are thriving in the Teton Mountains of Wyoming in a colder northern part of their range. They also found that the decline in California was likely not due solely to climate change, but probably a combination of other factors such as disease or fire. The scientists warned that the loss of pikas could have a profound impact on their mountain habitats. Despite their small stature, the animals play an outsized role on the ecosystem, spreading seeds and redistributing nutrients. And Beaver said, in the areas with the greatest body of research, the data indicate a near certain decline. And you could find that and other news at insideclimatenews.org. And Yellowstone River fish deaths are due to warming waters in this story by Bob Berwin of Inside Climate News. An outbreak of fish-killing disease along a 100-mile stretch of the Yellowstone River in Montana may be the latest sign of mountain stream ecosystems being disrupted by climate change. Scientists point to warmer, slower rivers as a cause of the mass fish mortality. Since August 12th, the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks has counted 4,000 dead white mountain whitefish, along with smaller numbers of dead rainbow trout, Yellowstone cutthroat, long-nosed suckers, sculpin, and long-nosed dace. The agency estimates that tens of thousands of fish may be dead, and they closed a segment to recreation to reduce impacts to fish. This is happening along a river that's an economic mainstay for nearby communities and thought of as a relatively healthy undammed river. The culprit is a microscopic capsule-shaped parasite called Tetracapsuloides bryosalmonae. In slower, warmer water, both impacts of climate change, the parasites thrive while the stressed fish grow weaker. More and more of the spores invade the fish through their gills, eventually overwhelming the hosts. The disease, proliferative kidney disease, has been killing farm trout for decades. In the last 20 years, it has taken an increasing toll on wild trout populations in Austria, Germany, and Switzerland. It has also killed salmon in Norway and Arctic char in Iceland, where studies on the outbreak suggest links with warmer water temperatures. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. If you want to hear our broadcast, tune in tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. That's Friday at 3. In North Adams, Massachusetts, tune in to WNMB 107.1 Fridays at 5:30 in the morning. Moscow, Idaho, on KRFP 90.3 FM, you can hear the show rebroadcast Wednesdays at 3. In Dade City, Florida, WLSL at 92.7 broadcasts the show Sunday mornings at noon. And on the Grateful Dread Public Radio broadcast at gdprnashville.org, you can tune in and tune out at Sunday at 2 a.m. Or you could go to radioforall.net and listen online or download at any time. That's radio4all.net. And please ask your local nonprofit community radio station to air the Earth First Update every week. It is free to download and air. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next week for another edition of the Earth First Update.